You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of September 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tyler Brulé. On today's show, as USA Today joins a slew of American newspapers reversing criticizing Donald Trump, we'll ask what kind of influence these publications have in the presidential race. One man has already made up his mind.
I think the media is among the most dishonest groups of people I've ever met. And believe me, if I become president, oh, do they have problems. They're going to have such problems.
Not sure who's sounding more raspy today, me or Donald. Anyway, also on the show, we'll cross over to our bureau in Istanbul to learn how living under an ongoing state of emergency affects life in the state itself. We'll also be scrutinizing claims being made about trade in a post-Brexit economy by the ministers in charge of those negotiations.
The UK, let me remind you, is a full and founding member of the WTO, though we have chosen to be represented by the EU in recent years. As we establish our independent position post-Brexit, we will carry the standard of free and open trade as a badge of honour.
And we'll be taking British Airways to task on its decision to withdraw complimentary meals on its short-haul flights. We should qualify that to the back of the plane. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé. And welcome to Studio One here at Midori House, a place where we have all the answers, because we're going to kick off today talking about our new book, that book being The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining. And I'm happy to say that we have the man who is in charge of, well, not just all of the beautiful pages that he's flicking through at the moment, but really the helmsman of the book side of the business. Andrew Tuck is here. And it's very, very nice to see you around the table. You're, of course, a late-breaking guest to the lineup. Also, our executive and foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, is here today as well. And Henry Reese Sheridan, of course, a very familiar voice. And he is, of course, one of our producers here at Monocle 24. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Andrew, so we'll be talking a little bit about this whole... Why don't we just talk about this British Airways story now, in fact, just to keep them on their toes in the control room. Many years ago, we saw so many carriers. They were, of course, terrified about the rise of low-cost carriers, so that meant they had to cut everything out. And we should probably sort of, you know, rewind. This is not the first time that the British Airways has cut product and what is on offer on the trolley in the back of the plane happened before. There's been experiments, of course, in the past with charging. Many other legacy carriers have done this. But you've got our new book there, and I see you've got the page open. Perfect to cheese toasties, it looks like, which is exactly what you want. Doesn't matter where you're sitting on the plane.
I was looking for some serving suggestions for BA.
I
think the Gruyere and Speck toasty would go down well with people. I like that. I think it's a good offering. I'm not sure, actually, at the back of the plane, how long there has been much meal offer anyway.
Well, this is the point. I mean, you know, Steve, how excited do you get? No matter what the airline is, you know, trolley comes out and you see so many people just saying, you know, I'm going to take a pass on that.
Well, indeed, in a way, I wonder whether it actually matters anymore, because when you look at most airports now around the world, and obviously not all of them, but the food offerings that you get at the airport now that you can take away with you are a lot better than they were 20 years ago. So in a sense, maybe it doesn't matter so much whether BA or others actually give you food on a plane, when actually you know that as long as you arrive, you know, in good time at the airport, you can go somewhere else and pick up something that's not too bad.
I think mostly they're offering a kind of a nut bag or a cookie at the moment.
I know,
well, a bag of nuts are available down the back of the plane, come this way. But I think actually Steve makes a good point, because there is also that awful moment. I was on a plane just coming back from Barcelona the other day, and there was a storm going over the airport, so we couldn't take off. I had bought a very nice kind of meal to eat on the plane because I didn't want to have the trolley food. And they said...
Before you took off?
Yeah, before we took off.
Yeah,
and
right.
Then we got on the plane and they said, we're going to be held on the ground. All flights are cancelled from Barcelona. And then the time started ticking. It was like 1 hour. We're going to be here another hour sitting on the plane. I thought, I'm going to have my food. So I had a really nice little meal, you know, I had a nice kind of bottle of drink, and you could see the people around me wanted to kill me. But, you know, what do you do? What do you do?
But you got to eat,
They didn't even get their bag of nuts.
Mr. Richard, you're looking peckish over there.
Yeah, I'm a little bit, I mean, I'm a big admirer of snack innovation on planes. And actually, when I was flying to Vienna early in the year on Austria Airlines for the Quality of Life conference, I was
You like red tights, don't you?
I'm a big fan, as you know. And I'm also was a big fan of the snack they had on offer, Cloud Hoppers. I'll always remember them. It was a hybrid bag of both plane-shaped biscuits and pretzels. They didn't force you to choose. And it's that kind of blue sky thinking, if you'll forgive the pun, that I'd like to see.
And they're called Cloud Hoppers.
They're called Cloud Hoppers, yeah, I remember the name. Yeah, look them up.
I wonder if it's an Austrian Austrian innovation.
Yeah, I like that. I like that they've branded their snacks in an experiential way. It's good. Yeah.
Steve, do you think this is a Q4 announcement? That somehow BA needs to save several million, so we're just going to cut the food on all short haul flights and we'll make our numbers.
It has that feel to it. Yes, I'm sure they've crunched the numbers and realised that this actually, you know, our losses are only this, or our sort of we've hit our profit. Yeah, it is quite possible. Of course, what's interesting is they're doing this at the same time as so many other airlines are also then trying to outcompete themselves with what they offer, you know, for those who sit in the front. So there's a bit of a divide opening up. But as I say, I don't think it matters as much as it would have done ten years ago.
Yeah. And culturally, I think what's more important is this gives a hint at not just the British Airways, but it gives a hint when airlines are doing this that they're cost cutting, and they're cost cutting everywhere. Mm. So that's why you get a dirty plane when you get on. That's why the people who are kind of looking after you, supposedly on the plane, are less happy because they're being paid a little bit less than they should be. We did a really interesting event last night with Cathay Pacific where we had a discussion about the future of travel. And one of the gentlemen said to me, he said, it's surprising how many airlines you get on these days where you realise that the cabin crew hate you before you sit down. And he said that is the difference with Cathay, that he felt that there was a relationship where it was positive, but he felt there was a kind of an animosity on many planes these days.
There's another interesting thing with food on a plane, which is, of course, it is, you know, depending on the airline, it's your first real interaction with that country that you're going to. So if you're flying ANA, you're on your way to Japan and you get the Japanese breakfast, it's your first example of Japanese food and you feel you're into it. Now, if you're flying on BA, no one is, as they come to London, is like, oh, I can't wait to taste that brilliant British food. Now, they might like the food when they arrive here because London's got an amazing food scene, but none of it is British food.
Or if you're Henry and you're on your way to Vienna, I'm getting the cloud hoppers and that's going to be your first introduction, right?
I also do want to actually question that sentiment on the part of Steve, because I'm not sure if you read the menu, but there are Percy Pigs available in the snack section, which I couldn't think of something more representative of British culture. So I have to disagree with you on that point.
Okay, I concede that point.
Yeah, that's because it is M&S who are collaborating. We should say that. So it's pretty much everything you get at the checkout, isn't it?
Indeed.
Andrew, just on checkout, because the weekend is upon us. It's always a great time for e-commerce, I have to say. You have the new book in front of us. We had a great event. And just quickly, aside from cheese toasties, what else will people get? Tell us in 50 words or less, please.
It's a survey for people who want to eat well, eat better, drink in interesting places, start their own enterprise, become part of the neighbourhood with a restaurant, and who just have an appreciation for food that is genuine, honest, tasty, served by nice people in nice environments, and has bugger all to do with foam and froth.
122 words. But anyway, we're going to go away for a very short break. We're going to start this show then in earnest, and we're going to be heading across the Atlantic. You're listening to Midori House. It's 18:09 here in London. Stay with us.
The well-turned-out, style-themed October issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. We tour the globe for the best in the world of retail, with a ranking of the companies and developers doing it best from Sydney to Seoul, past Porto and Poznan. Here's what our sharp-eyed editors have spotted for you this month.
In the design section, we set sail to Copenhagen to see the striking modernist headquarters of shipping giant Maersk.
In the edits pages, we make reservations at a late night restaurant started by the talented souls behind Apartamento magazine in Barcelona.
Monocle's October issue is on newsstands now, or guarantee your copy by joining as a Monocle subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
And you're back in Studio One here at Midori House with me, Tyler Berlay, Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield, and Henry Reese Sheridan. And you're listening to Midori House. We were saying in the menu, talking about, of course, all of these proclamations across front pages regarding the US presidential race. Newspapers have always, of course, played something of a vital role in swaying public opinion on which candidates to go for, of course. But the tone of editorial endorsements has, until now, always been largely positive. This week, USA Today has broken with tradition by publishing an anti-endorsement of Donald Trump. The paper's editorial board said, from the day he declared his candidacy 15 months ago through this week's first presidential debate, Trump has demonstrated repeatedly that he lacks the temperament, knowledge, steadiness, and honesty that America needs from its presidents. It follows a slew of other U.S. titles, recently changing tack after having supported a Republican candidate in every election historically. Steve, we need to start with you. What does this signal? Is it as much of a commentary on also the state of U.S. media, the role that papers need to play, maybe looking across to this side of the Atlantic a little bit as well? Is it just about the candidate in question?
It's a bit about the candidate in question, but there's also this issue about, does it really matter? Has anyone's vote ever really been swayed by what the editorial board of a newspaper says? Now, I think votes can be swayed by newspapers. We've seen that here in the UK, where you had essentially a generation of, for about 25, 30 years, you had stories against the European Union, which helped to sow the seed of Britain leaving the European Union. Now, if, for example, The Sun had suddenly come out in favour of staying in the EU, I don't think that would have made much of a difference. Mm. It's the tone of the coverage over a period of time that makes a difference. I think there's going to be very few readers of USA Today, for example, who are going to look at that and go, okay, fine, I'm not voting for Donald Trump.
Andrew.
I agree with Steve that I don't think it will sway people in that way. But I think what's interesting is seeing, people who would normally fall behind Trump, even in the Republican Party, saying, actually, I'm beginning to take a stand. I think the people felt it was rather entertaining in the early months and a little bit fearful, even many people who had been his supporters or his potential supporters. I think the other strange thing about his rhetoric, though, is, without getting too carried away, he's saying to a lot of people who are, who, let's be honest, have probably got guns and bad tempers, saying, these people are corrupt, these people are dangerous. He's picking out journalists. And, he goes on a TV debate and he loses and he says, well, it's a conspiracy because they turned down my mic. They deliberately tried to stop me being president. And you can see that at the end of that journey, it would only take one crackpot to think, actually, Mr. Trump would have been president if it wasn't for X presenter or X anchor. And then suddenly you can see something rather horrible happening. And that, I think that's the scary thing about his rhetoric. He unleashes what he feels is just kind of entertainment. But there are people listening who will act on what he says.
Henry, on the part of the newspapers, is it too little, too late, do you think?
I agree with both Andrew and Steve that I do not...
That's very wise.
Just my line there. I don't think that this is going to affect anything. A big reason for that is that I think a lot of Trump supporters are defined by their dismissal of the mainstream media, have been from the beginning. And actually, it's difficult, I think, to imagine a media outlet which could significantly harm Trump, I think, with an attack at this stage. One interesting aspect to the same gemstone, I think, of this, is the contortions that some high-level Republicans are having to go into at the moment to endorse Trump while still maintaining their integrity. Most remarkably, I think about a fortnight ago now, maybe just under, Ted Cruz, whose animosity towards Trump was mutual and extreme during the primary contest, has said that after a long period of prayer, he is only going to be able to vote for him in the elections, which is quite extraordinary. It's very interesting all around, I think.
The strange thing is that actually, on that issue of Republicans supporting Trump and now sort of trying to either desperately sort of keep quiet or hide away, is that when you look at the most recent outburst that Donald Trump made, which was this morning, Eastern Time, between 5:15 and 5:30 a.m., one suspects he was up late rather than up early, but who knows, a quite astonishing tirade on Twitter against this former Miss Universe, Alicia Machado, encouraging Americans to search for a sex tape, which she allegedly, but actually everyone says, no, that's not true, did. This is the Republican nominee for president smearing a female voter and urging people to look for a sex tape. Now, if you were a senior Republican who wanted one day to be president, I reckon this morning you could probably stand up and say, you know what, I've been trying to support Donald Trump, but this goes too far. Your career in the Republican Party is not going to be over if you do that.
Andrew, we talked about it briefly. I watched the debate on, Tuesday morning our time. And it was, you know, if you hadn't watched it, or if you only saw maybe a 15-second snippet, you would have thought it was a complete car crash. But, you know, it wasn't a car crash, at least, you know, from my view, you know, sitting through sort of, you know, not 90 minutes of it. But, you know, that's when, you know, sort of everyone sort of woke up, at least on this side of the Atlantic anyway. It's in the bag for her. But it's not the case. And I think probably as we're all saying as well, you know, if you're not sort of there consuming and you don't believe what the big three networks, the rolling news channels other than Fox News say, you don't sort of really give a stuff.
Well, it was interesting. We had that conversation. I'd been up ridiculously early that day and I hadn't seen the debate. So actually the next night I watched the debate on catch up. And after we'd had that conversation before we went home, I kind of watched it and I imagined taking him out of the picture. Mm. Looking at the things he was saying, taking out the kind of the parameters of craziness and looking at the points. And, you know, one of the points that, you know, we discussed in the office and I kind of listened to him make, it was about infrastructure. He said, you know, he made a point. He said, how come we have airports in the United States that are
third world?
You know, he said, when I go to China and I land in a Chinese airport, they have amazing airports. Why do we, at this point in our history, not have good infrastructure for traveling? Now, actually, it was a really good point. You know, we've all asked that question. Why doesn't, you know, why is it when you land at JFK, is there not a high-speed rail network into the city? Why is LaGuardia and JFK always kind of an absolute nightmare to get through? And he's got a point. So, in fact, he was making some salient points, which I think she has difficulty answering. And I think, you know, Obama has a halo effect in global affairs and around the world. And, you know, Michelle Obama is, you know, a great dancer and can get down with anyone and is entertaining and good fun. But when you look at Obama's record, if you're tough on it, you say, well, you know, we certainly don't have peace in the Middle East. You know, the policy on Syria has been an absolute disaster. The engagement with Russia, the way that that has been dealt with is nothing to be happy about. And, you know, he's been absent from many of the key decisions that had to be made. So I think actually, that Trump has some things to cling on to.
We're often sat around this table, in fact, going, well, why do people support Donald Trump? What is it about them? And there was a line which I wish I could remember who said it and credit them with it. But he said, Donald Trump's supporters take him seriously, but they don't take him literally, his word. However, people like us take him literally, but don't take him seriously. And I think that's a thing we need to remember. Yes, he says things that are crazy. Yes, he says things which are that are racist and race-baiting. But also, as Andrew points out, there are things where he gets the nub of some issues that actually a lot of Americans care rather deeply about. And, you know, they don't necessarily want to know what his $33 billion plan for fixing infrastructure in America is. They just want to know that he's like, this is ridiculous, we should fix it.
Henry.
Sorry, are you two pulling a Ted Cruz? I just want to check here. Are you coming
absolutely
out as a late stage?
No, but
just trying to explain this.
Think after we've had, you know, the ridiculous Brexit vote here, you know, you worry about this. You look at it with that filter. You're thinking, you know, it's great being, you know, part of a metropolitan world, and we meet all these people who, you know, have good lives, interesting, are entrepreneurs and fix their neighborhoods and all these things. But there is a lot of people who are rural, disconnected, hate politics, never vote, will, you know, believe in the gun above everything else, and they see in him a champion.
And you brought up Brexit, and I know we probably have our Chris Lord standing by on the line in Istanbul, but he can be with his nice glass of Turkish red a little bit longer, because we should talk Brexit. Economic outlook for the UK after June's disastrous referendum result is still being assessed by the global trade and financial sector. We see that all the time. UK politicians, of course, you know, such as Liam Fox, the Secretary of State for International Trade, remains optimistic. Yesterday, he claimed that trade with the European Union will remain at least as free as it ever was for the UK. And, of course, he's also said it could be up to other nations to ensure the process doesn't harm trade relations. Steve, is he right?
No. No, he's not. It was interesting listening to his speech. He talked a lot about NAFTA and how good the North American Free Trade Agreement was. And he thought, well, we've got one of those here. It's called the European Union. It's kind of bizarre when you stand back and think about it. But we voted to leave the European Union 3 months ago, and people still don't know what that means. And you've got a Prime Minister, Theresa May, who has this slogan, Brexit means Brexit. But no one knows what Brexit means. And she can say it until she's blue in the face. But, you know, until they actually invoke Article 50 and say we're going to leave and start negotiations with their European partners, this is all just cloud cuckoo land. And people like Liam Fox can say, oh, everything's going to be fine. But that's a hope. That's a dream. Mm. Of course, we want everything to be fine. But why should we expect our European neighbours to say, we're going to give you a brilliant trade deal as good as the one you've got right now?
And that's the point about impossibility. Matteo Renzi, Italian Prime Minister, said it would be impossible for Brexit talks to result in a deal that gives Britons more rights than others outside the EU. Would you say that's under the view of certainly every other finance minister, every other leader within the constellation?
It's just logical. That's the point of being in a club. You get special rights. That's the whole point of it. You know, Liam Fox is a man who comes across as of little consequence and, you know, just ridiculous, you know, right-wing rhetoric. But the thing that I don't know, for me personally, the thing that I have found so weird over the post-vote is I feel absolutely no connection with the British political world whatsoever. I find, you know, a Labour Party bereft of hope, a Liberal Democratic Party with no opportunity, and a Conservative Party which I didn't vote in, with a leader I didn't vote in, and with a group of ministers who I don't believe in. So it's strange, I almost watch the negotiations and the discussion about what the negotiations will be with a kind of distance. And I guess that's what many British people felt before when they didn't feel connected to the world of politics. I just don't feel it's got that much to do with me. I don't think I can affect it. And I think, you know, we as a business, we as people, will begin to rewire our lives on our own to try and avoid the worst consequences.
And are you feeling as optimistic as Andrew?
I think, you know, as we people begin to make more statements along the sort, and we kind of get into the nitty-gritty granular level of policymaking for Brexit, what people are beginning to realise is that the incumbent British government is presiding over a uniquely potent window of opportunity for shaping the country for the next 10, 20, 30 years. And the thing that I'm angriest about, and I know it's something that Steve feels very strongly about as well, is that the opposition hasn't shown up. Labour hasn't shown up. And particularly in light of the re-election of Jeremy Corbyn last weekend as Labour leader, I don't think this is going to change. Emily Thornberry, who is the Shadow Foreign Secretary, is doing the Shadow Secretary of State for exiting the European Union, a slightly cumbersome term, but that is the governmental position dealing with it, part-time. So, you know, the thing that makes me most angry is that some of the most effective opposition to, you know, what could turn into misguided Brexit policy is coming from within the Conservative Party.
Steve, we've gone from Andrew sort of being disengaged and unhappy. We have angry Henry over here. How's the temperature down there?
Weirdly, I'm a mix of the two. I'm disengaged and angry. And I think there's a real issue here. There are two things that the European Union is essentially all about. One is the single market. And most people are in agreement that it'd be quite good if we sort of stayed in the single market in some place or had some sort of trade thing. The other is this issue of freedom of movement. And you're seeing even some people who are on the Labour side of Remain, like Chukwuemeka, saying, well, maybe actually we need to end freedom of movement, and sounding a little more anti-immigration. And so it's actually a little hard to work out what the differences of opinion are now between the two parties. And it's the most frustrating thing to talk about because you can't grab hold of it. I don't know what we're talking about really anymore. We voted we're going to leave the European Union. Right, what do we do next? Well, we don't know. We can talk about it, but we're not actually going to do it. It's immensely frustrating.
Or we can go to a very short break.
Let's do that.
As well. We're heading off to Istanbul right after this to talk to our Chris Lord.
They've reported, listened, watched, quizzed and cajoled. They've been to farms and galleries, conclaves and bars. They've reported from the high north and tropical metropolises. And you? Well, all you need to do is turn the dial, click our app or pop in your headphones and head off on an audio tour of the spikiest, juiciest, funniest moments from Monocle 24's Week That Was. The Curator is our one-hour show that informs, entertains and surprises with the best bits of all our magazine shows, from The Urbanist to The Menu, The Stack to The Entrepreneur's Culture to Section D, premiering live every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time. You can also subscribe to the programme at monocle.com or on iTunes or on SoundCloud to ensure that you never miss a beat. Come on, let's catch up this weekend. Listen to The Curator.
And welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé, Henry Sheridan, Steve Bloomfield, and Andrew Tuck. It is time to go to Turkey now, gentlemen, where President Erdogan has again suggested an extension of the nation's state of emergency in a speech in Ankara on Thursday. Erdogan proffered 3 months more, but also played with the idea of extending it beyond a year. To quote, maybe 12 months won't be enough, he said. The country has suspended around 100,000 members of Turkey's vital services as part of the policy, and 40,000 more are currently detained. Well, we're now joined by our very own Chris Lord. He is in our bureau in Istanbul. Good evening.
Good evening to you all.
Sounds very lonely there. I think you need a big table in, and maybe Andrew, we... a little bit more budget for a bit of like sound buffing in there as well, or some more warm bodies. Anyway, something like that. Chris, state of emergency. How much has, you know, if you just landed, if you came in on your Turkish Airlines flight, your Lufthansa flight, you didn't know what was going on, you'd never picked up a paper, would you feel that there's a state of emergency?
That's the really surreal thing about being here, is that I can walk out of this bureau now and it will look like a typical Friday night in Istanbul. People will be going out to the Meyhanis, going out for a night out, going for restaurants and so on and so forth. But it's all really just a big veneer in the sense that, you know, as you mentioned underneath it all, tens of thousands of people detained right across through society, from military personnel right through to journalists, high profile journalists as well. Just this week, we've seen 12 TV stations shut down overnight. I think that the most important thing here in terms of getting out of the airport, what you're going to see is the economic impact that this state of emergency is going to have. We've just seen this Moody's, put Turkey's credit rating into the junk territory, which is going to have some massive impacts as we look forward towards 2017. And what this really, essentially, this state of emergency is going to start to do is just eat away at those businesses. We're already seeing bars and restaurants closing down. People that have been here for years and years operating are just not able to keep up. And I think, you know, that's what you feel when you walk out onto the street at the moment in Istanbul. In one sense, there's this sort of veneer of respectability. Everything looks as it typically does. But then if you just look that little bit closer, whether that's on the headlines or whether that's, you know, down in the back streets, those bars closing down, that's where you feel how that state of emergency is just, you know, really perforating people's lives, I would say.
Andrew, you had a very alarming, illuminating discussion with a very prominent, not just gentleman from Istanbul, but a very prominent Turk not just in the industrial sector, but beyond. Is this exactly what Erdogan wants in a way, when we hear about bars closing down and that sort of liberal side of not just Istanbul life, but daily life in general? Is that going pretty much in the direction that he would like it to head?
Well, I think this is the worst thing about this failed coup, is it has given Erdogan the remit to make many changes that would have been very difficult or impossible just 6 months ago. And yeah, some of the conversations I've had with prominent Turks here in London saying, you know, they feel very threatened. They feel that they must not speak out under any circumstances. They must not have any political opinions, that they need to be going home of an evening and keeping with their families. And there's a real sense that, you know, you need to be cautious about what you do and say in contemporary Turkey until we find out what happens.
I think Andrew's right. And one of the problems here is that Turkey's Western allies in Europe and also in the United States have decided they're not going to try and put any pressure or interfere in any way with President Erdogan. In Europe, it's because we need his help on the refugee crisis. In America, it's because they need his help on Syria. And so whereas maybe even 5 years ago, and obviously then there was also that, you know, he was influenced by Abdullah Gül, who was then president, who was more moderate and more open-minded. He was influenced by Ahmet Davutoğlu, who had a more open foreign policy as his foreign minister. Now it's just him on his own. Gül and Davutoğlu have gone. The EU just wants Turkey's support for refugees. There are very few people or organisations that can put him under any sort of outside pressure.
Mm. Chris, just before we go, and sorry that we got to you so late, but tell us, does state of emergency in a way just sort of blend into business as usual?
I think so. In terms of what Steve's saying there, I think absolutely so. I think the important thing to remember with this state of emergency is that it gives the government executive powers, as in they can push laws through and decrees very, very quickly and easily. Now, we have to remember that throughout this whole process, there's a backstory that Erdogan would like to do a constitutional referendum delivering himself exactly those executive powers, essentially making the prime ministerial role obsolete. Now, when you put that into context, essentially this state of emergency has delivered himself exactly what he wants. As long as that state of emergency is in place, he has executive power. And so in the sense of business as usual, I think there's become a sort of new normal has become here, as it's ramped up over the last few years, really, I suppose, since around 2011. It's just been a continual process of sort of breaking down that sense that there is a sort of base of constitution, there is a rule of law, that if you are in government, you're party to that. And I think Erdogan, by simply saying to the people, you know, we can go beyond 12 months if we so desire, is only really saying to people that actually those agreed laws don't really mean anything. Those constitutional rights don't mean anything, because if he did, he'd have to stop this state of emergency after 6 months, and it sounds like he doesn't really want to do.
Chris Lord, our man in Istanbul, thank you very much for that. Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield, Henry Rhys Sheridan, our men in London, thanks to you. Also, I should say that today's show is produced by Tom Hall and Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Luke Saunders. Our studio manager today has been Weidong Lin. More music is coming up next. Then at 1900, Marcus Hippie will be here with The Menu. And we'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House is back at the very same time tomorrow. No, it's not. It's going to be back on Monday. In fact, not tomorrow. I'm Tyler Brulé. I'm going to be at Oktoberfest checking in on the weekend edition. More then. Goodbye.